I have no deep textual insights from the pages of the Bible, in other words. Although in a few minutes, I would like to say some very specific things about this church and its future. But before that, if your forgiveness will work again, I'd like to share an experience from a recent trip Billy and I took with John and Kim Carraway and Dusty, all members of this church. I will resist talking about 6 days on the wild and beautiful Middle Fork of the Salmon River in Idaho, because that would strike some people as purely pagan joy, although I felt I was in a cathedral most of the time. I will say only of that trip that of the 6 people in our entire group who were thrown out of the rafts and into the ice-cold water, only one was from this church. And that one was a lovely, gracious lady whom it might be hard for you to imagine in the rapids of a mountain river. I leave the rest up to you. No other details from that wonderful week, unless, of course, in private, you insist. But intense religious moments I can properly share from this pulpit, and there was one of those I shall not forget for a while. We were in the tiny resort town of Stanley, Idaho, for a couple of days, waiting for the Carraways to fly over the mountains from Boise. And since one of those days fell on a Sunday, we found a log chapel beside a primitive grass airstrip and sandwiched our worship time in between those of the Mormons and the Catholics, who also used the little interfaith chapel. We were delighted and impressed with the laymen who welcomed us that morning, about 30 of us, a warm, personable gentleman who kept the place going as a labor of love. He worked at the salmon fish hatchery during the week and used his spare time to fix a pew or put down new carpet and get ready for Sunday. The word for him, devout. Totally unpretentious, open, honest face, gentle with his 2 small children, he made us feel good about being in church. The hymns were a little ragged, and the pleasant woman who sat at the electronic organ had never played one before, so we had some strange squawks in odd places, but no one really minded. Our friend from the fish hatchery had invited a professional clergyman to come up on Sundays for the next 6 weeks from some small town in Idaho, and he introduced this man with great delight and anticipation. I looked at him when he sat down to listen, and I've never seen more eagerness on a face. He was literally thirsty for words from Scripture and from life, from our guest speaker. For the next half hour, I had the pain of seeing that joy fade slowly, to be replaced by a puzzled look, and perhaps even a little pain at the thought of the Sundays yet to come. Because our guest speaker turned out to be a bit of a disappointment. He was too good a man and too earnest to make fun of, but he began with the strangest comment I have ever heard from a pulpit. He said, "I'm going to read to you from Jeremiah the prophet, but I need to warn you that I have a little problem. When I read the scriptures in public, I tend to yawn. I could not imagine how it would be possible to yawn while reading aloud before an audience, but it turned out that he had told us the truth. I tried hard to follow as he went along without much order, but my attention began to wander, and I tried to find something else to engage my mind. I'm sure you understand this. I have seen people in the balcony gaze out the windows at the beautiful meadow to the east, and I've never blamed them. If they had the view I had that morning in Idaho, they would probably never stay with me for more than a couple of minutes at a time. You have probably seen one of those mountain chapels where the whole end of the building, behind the pulpit, was clear glass from floor to ceiling, filled from one side to the other with the enormous sweep of snow-capped mountains. Well, I had filled up with that scenery during the minutes before worship, and I had not meant to look at them anymore, but they turned out to be more compelling than the sermon. I felt a little guilty, so I asked myself, all right, and I called myself by a derogatory name I never reveal in public, what would you do if you had been invited to speak? I thought about how Jesus had looked down at the flowers in a meadow one day and used them as his text. And then I looked some more at the awesome peaks of the Sawtooth Range, serrated sharply against a deep blue sky, huge ramparts of granite with bowls and valleys of snow dazzling white in the morning sun. Would it work, I wondered, if a guest speaker were simply to get up and say, good morning, everyone. Before I say anything more, I want you to sit there for a moment and really look at those mountains. Fill your eyes with the beauty of them. Fill your mind with thoughts of the slow millenniums they represent, incredible expanses of time in contrast with our buzzing little moments. Let's just sit here a bit in silence and look at them. And then, after a time, start talking again. So what do they say to us, these mountains, of the mystery at the beginning and the end of our days? How do you relate them to the talk of creation versus evolution? Do they give us, at least for an hour, a different pulse to live by? What do they tell us of the nature of that power to which we have given the name of God? Is he in this soaring majesty, this immutable massif of granite and quartz? Here we sit, I thought, in this artificial and temporary little box of rough cedar, paying no attention to a message of incredible power all around us, trying to care about the confusing words of Jeremiah the prophet from 2,500 years ago. And as we pray, a cool, sweet wind sighs around the windows, And I hear it whisper with Columbine on its breath, "What are you doing in here? Why are you so strangely cut off from reality? How can you wander about and be so lost in theological minutiae when all this glory would open your mind and quicken new thought if you would only allow it?" Well, you have only the meadow, and not all of you can see it if you need to be distracted. So I will try to be relevant to this particular occasion and briefly say a word about church growth and new members and how we treat one another. I've just finished a book, small paperback book, called The Inviting Church. A book made up entirely of research conducted by the Alban Institute to see how churches get new members and how they keep them. I am delighted to find support for some things I have said to you several times from this pulpit, that recruitment, if a church is what it should be, tends to take care of itself, but that assimilation of new members takes some very careful thought. In the matter of recruitment, I've been convinced for a long time that word of mouth is the best advertising method for a church, and these studies confirm that. An astonishing 80 to 86% said that they were drawn to visit the church through the recommendation of a friend or a relative. Only 7% came because of an ad in the newspaper. Quite a few said they came first because the church looked inviting from the outside. It seemed to be a plus that the architecture should reflect the identity and tradition of the church. So I'm glad we went to extra time and trouble to make this house reminiscent of those lovely old New England colonial churches. I quite disagreed with somebody's comment in the book that the sign in front should avoid fancy lettering, should, quote, "never, never, never use an old English script. Too difficult to read, gives the church an archaic air, not the kind of image you want to project." Well, I think that's dead wrong. A congregational church needs an old English script to hint at its long and distinguished history. But, having been chastised already this morning, it would be fun to hear from you. Would you have preferred modern block lettering? Once inside the building, a visitor gets impressions from how clean the place is. Some respondent said, "If the bathroom is really tidy, my estimate of the whole church rises." Young couples with children want neat and tidy classrooms. They equate what they see with the kind of care their children will receive. Visitors want to feel harmony and cooperation among the members of a church. No one wants to be in a group that quarrels. And they like a sense of energy, that people are happily involved in running the place, cleaning it up, making it beautiful, taking part in study groups, helping others. In other words, growing churches were not places to which one escaped. They demanded some time, involvement, and enthusiasm. I was intrigued by the research team's discovery that if the congregation had this high involvement, newcomers wanted in, even if the congregation did not make it particularly easy for them. One person who had joined her church the year before the interview said, "You have to fight your way into this church. It's not that they want to keep you out or that they are indifferent. Rather, they are so into what they are doing that they don't seem to really notice you and help you find your place here." I think, with a mixture of joy and regret, that we probably resemble that remark. The study makes it clear that no church can be all things to all people. An approach to worship or to the study of the Bible that is stretched thin enough to please everybody ends up exciting nobody. It's not possible to devise a program for all the needs of all who come. But it appears that if a church is warm and friendly, people will come despite not having every program they need. But the warmth, this little book says over and over again, is essential. People kept saying, "We looked for warmth, welcome, a caring community." One church interviewed found out that people in the town referred to it as God's frozen chosen. That is a death sentence. We have been extraordinarily lucky with the number and quality of new members entering this church since we opened the doors 2 years ago. Keeping them is a bigger job than enrolling them. And that, I think, has to be always a two-way responsibility. First, we commit ourselves to saying, "Hello, Jim. Good morning, Betty," before and after worship. And we encourage them, as soon as they are willing, to get acquainted with others through service on a church board or attending social events. But new members should not simply wait for us to make those moves. Unless they are painfully shy, we hope with all our hearts that they will walk up to at least a couple of families every Sunday and say, "Hi, we're the McMillans, Michael and Sandy. We're the Pistotniks, Brian and Debbie. We're new in the church, and we'd like to know more people." According to the research I've been using this morning, people who become active in a church will have identified an average of 7 new friends in the first 6 months. That seems amazingly low to me. But even that number helps bind new members to their church. Dropouts, it turns out, will have made less than 2 friends. Friendship seems to be the strongest single bond cementing most new members to their church, and the first 6 months are crucial. I promise all of you, longtime members and new alike, that we have some events coming up in this next church year that will increase our chances to know one another better. And until then, I am tempted for the first time in my grown-up life to repeat a rousing admonition my boyhood preacher used to shout at all of us at the end of every service. He would do the benediction, and then, as sure as death and taxes, he would look up as the audience began to dissolve and say, "Everybody, shake hands and be friendly. Let's do it this morning.